Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on the companies we mention. Please do your own research.
So, welcome to Mums, Monday Upbeat Markets, and where I am right now, it's still Sunday, but where you are, it is Monday the 27th of April. Is that 4 months of the year gone already? Charles, it's like, where did it go?
Where did it go indeed? Well, it feels like in the Trump US world, it's been a rather sort of rapid fire 4 months, where I mean, half the world has been invaded. It's kind of hard to keep track with what's going on. But on a personal level, it's warm outside in the UK. It's sunny. It hasn't rained for a week. It's lovely.
Tremendous. And about an hour ago, I was in the Pacific Ocean and getting smashed by a few waves. So there you go. Sorry for telling you all of that. So anything else happening in the UK that we should know about, Charles?
Well, not too much. I mean, every politician is still deeply unpopular. Nobody seems to have any kind of majority. The country's basically ungovernable because people's demands on the government are higher than the amount of tax being paid, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. But on the flip side, you know, we went to the beach yesterday. The day before, we were at a barbecue. It's nice, it's pleasant, and somebody just could be grateful for the enjoyable little moments in life.
Indeed. I saw your article that you wrote about not spending all your money on shares when you're in your 20s and just enjoying life, and that was very poignant. I think it was very good.
Well, I think people kind of, you forget, right, that like, it's the same as I say, you know, having children in your 20s is also probably a good idea, because the standard financial advice is to wait until you're 100% set up and financially ready. But then if you do that, it tends to be you have kids in your late 30s, early 40s, and then you're raising teenagers when you should be hitting peak earnings years. Whereas if you have young children in your 20s, and it's not for everybody, you don't earn any money in your 20s, so it's not going to hit you financially at all. And likewise, it's the same with saving and investing. If you've got $3,000-$4,000 spare from whatever you earn in your 20s, put that into investing. I mean, yeah, the returns in percentage terms will be great, but in absolute terms, it's not going to be very much money at all for the vast majority of people. You're far better off, you know, training more, investing in yourself, going on holidays, having some life experience, and saving up money. I mean, obviously, you've got to be a little bit careful in this economy, but I mean, them's the breaks. I think it seems to be this massively overly financialized way of looking at the world. If you're 21, 22, even at, you know, for me, you know, I'm you know, mid 30s, I'm not as fast or as strong as what I was 15 years ago. It's just the way it is. And I won't be again 15 years from
now. Wait until you get to nearly 58, mate. I'll be 58 in a few weeks and you know about it, I tell you.
Anyway, good advice.
Anyway, let's welcome our first guest, James from Forgent.
James Parson and Ed Mead of Forgent PLC, welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets. How are you?
Thank you. Very good, thank you. Good morning to you.
Good. For those that don't know anything about Forgent PLC, can you give us a quick synopsis?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, for those that don't know, we're really a near-term copper and gold play, assets in Western Australia, and we're in this countdown to drilling by the summer. Now, we're a relaunch of EQ Tech. I got involved last October, and we've really made a lot of changes there, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about. But we've still here got in the background this proven waste-to-energy technology. So nothing's changed in terms of that core EQ Tech portfolio. We've layered onto it some of these mining assets, which we really think bring those near-term sort of price catalysts that everyone's interested in. So that's a little bit about the company at the moment. Ed's been working with us for some months now, and it is based out of Perth. Ed, why don't you just introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, sure. So my background as a geologist. I've been here in Western Australia for 30 years, working as a geo. I've worked all manner of commodities and also oil and gas. But based in Perth, Western Australia.
Okay, you must be milking it, Ed, with all the commodity boom, I would hope.
it swings between commodities all the time.
Yes, of course. And James, give us a bit of a background about yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm about 30 years, energy exec, oil and gas background and mining as well. The move into sort of clean tech, the gasification piece is relatively new to me. But, you know, I'm a real believer in that space. I think there's a lot of opportunity here. So, you know, I had 12 years with Shell at the beginning of my career and then have broadened out and been in multiple AIM vehicles and sort of, you know, around the microcap space for some time now.
Very good. James, there's obviously a lot of people who were invested in the EQTech story over a few years. And obviously it's not a pleasant story from a financial return point of view. So do you just want to paint the picture of what happened and you know, how did we get to the point that we're at now?
Yeah, certainly. Look, the reality is EQTech owns IP and has out of Barcelona a very good team in that gasification space. There is a graveyard out there of gasification companies and you know, EQTech arguably has done well to avoid being one of those. But the reality is, you know, we raised a lot of money. We started a lot of projects. We didn't finish as many projects as we'd like. And this now is still a revenue generating business. It still has strong technology and a strong team, but it doesn't have the scale that's needed yet. And the intent here really of this pivot, of this relaunch, let's call it, is to give the gasification a sort of gestation period, the time it needs to do what it needs to do to get back up to scale. So that's really what the introduction of these mining assets is all about, is bringing in some near-term price catalysts to sit alongside that gasification. But you're right, the history is messy. And you know, for what it's worth, apologies for that. I'm a relative newcomer to the story. But we do see opportunity here, and that's the key thing.
And looking at that, obviously the business was looking like it was going to go completely belly up a period of time ago. You had a debt of, I think, £5.76 million. And you seem to have done a pretty good job with that in terms of, you know, there is £1.9 million, I think, that is 5 years away now with no interest. There's another £1.9 million of that money, which is now basically equated into the Spanish company, if you like, so not held with Forgent, and then the other 1.9 million is with Forgent. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things, and there have been a few sort of, let's call them work streams for this cleanup job, one of them has been to sort out our capital structure. So as you rightly say, nearly 6 million of debt, which was a crazy level for a company of our scale. So what we did is split it into three component pieces. We, as you say, left one in Forgent, so the debt now is sub 2 million, and that's long-term, five-year, zero coupon, kicked into the long grass, and largely irrelevant, I would argue, for the equity story now, right? And that's the piece that's left, that's the cleaned-up vehicle. The other two pieces, we converted a third, and the other third, as you rightly say, we pushed into the Spanish sub, which is the gasification holding company. And that's the bet, obviously, those lenders took in the beginning. So it's kind of authentic and right that they continue with that bet. And that converts into 25% of the equity of that gasification sub at some point. So, look, we've cleaned up the vehicle. That was one of the strands of work around the relaunch, let's call it. And we're delighted to have done that and really appreciative of the support of the lenders. But that gives now the equity space, you know, to run and to operate. And that was the intent.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically now what we're looking at is Forgent market capitalization of about £3 million now, with this most recent raise of 1.3 million that you've just done. You now own 99% of Greenrock, which is a copper gold project, and 51% of Peak Hill. But you have the option to go up to 99% still, but that's obviously going to cost more money. So give us your motions of why you chose these products. Obviously, they're in, or not products, you know, I'm not even sure what the word is. These assets.
Basically. Yeah, these assets, right?
We're looking at these assets. They're in Western Australia. So, you know, you're in a fantastic jurisdiction. I think both of these assets are in regions of significance for copper and gold already, but you know, give us your view of why these particular assets were chosen.
Yeah, that's right. So look, Western Australia is important to say, and a lot of the mining opportunities worldwide are in less favourable jurisdictions. You know, you'll see a lot in Africa and elsewhere with all the inherent risks that come with that. Western Australia, this is a leading mining jurisdiction. So you've got a highly established operating environment. You've got strong infrastructure. You've got a good workforce. You know, we're lucky to have people like Ed available who know the assets, you know, in country. And you've got a clear and supportive regulatory framework. So, you know, the why Australia piece is sort of, you know, is explained in that way. And then these assets, well, look, I'm a believer big time in copper. I think with what's going on in the world, electrification on multiple levels, copper is a really interesting place to be right now and will remain interesting for the next 5 to 6 years. Gold obviously has had a huge run. It's come off a bit with what's going on in the Middle East. We're still very upbeat on that. Copper's our long-term bet. Gold is hot at the moment, remains hot despite that Middle East, you know, sort of issues. But these assets, whether it's Green Rock or Peak Hills, you know, they're highly prospective. They're early stage, but highly prospective. So you've got multiple high-grade surface expressions. You've got that exploration upside that I think AIM is just perfectly set up to try and capture. And you've got a defined pathway to some near-term drilling. And that's the key thing for us is getting some near-term inflection points out of these assets so that, you know, alongside the stuff that's going on in the background with gasification that will take longer than we want, but is there for us, that long-term value build, we've got near-term action. So really, these assets, which are largely, as you say, copper and gold, they're very much positioning us with near-term news flow. So we're on that countdown to summer drilling. You know, Ed has a lot of experience with these assets. We're relative newcomers, but we're picking them up cheap. We're putting limited capital in, and we've got huge potential accretion if they work. And that's the sweet spot for me for AIM stocks. That's where we should be. That's where we're positioning ourselves.
Yeah. Okay, Ed, we'll come on to you as the resident expert. Sorry for putting that on your shoulders, but as the geologist in this situation, we're gonna do that. So let's take the one that Forgent has 99% of, which is Green Rock. Tell us a little bit about the asset, the project, the scale, the potential scale of it, and what you're hoping to do over the next 6 to 12 months.
Oh, yeah, thanks. So I suppose, as James said, right, the you know, grades that we've hit up so far, you know, on surface have been, you know, up to 46.7% copper, you know, 5.31 grams per tonne gold. Which,
46% copper is basically you've just picked up a piece of copper.
Pretty much. Like, it's extremely rich, right? So, you know, I've said to James that one of the most important things that you try to do is that, like, you know, grade is king. So you can do a lot with grade. So, you know, there are multiple assay or rock chips that have been found. The areas that we think are highly prospective to have no drilling whatsoever. We've got a crew that's, you know, like basically on site at currently you know, extending known mineralization. And our aim is to, like, you know, build this up so that we can get in there with a drill rig later this year and, you know, and look subsurface to see what type of, like, widths of copper mineralization that there are. You know, interesting project. It's not too far from a port. You know, I've said, like, there's Onslow, which is an open access port, mainly for oil and gas and also for iron ore exports, is, you know, circa 160 kilometres away. So, you know, it's a great spot from Perth. It's about just over one day's drive, which probably sounds a lot to anybody else, but it's pretty close as far as Western Australia goes. You know, we've... Look forward to you know, announcing results from the project as they come to hand.
What type of system do you think it is? Is it a VMS or is it? You're not sure at this stage.
Look, not entirely sure. Like I always say, the one key thing before opening your mouth too wide is, like, we'd really like to have our guys on site doing a little bit further work. But you know, as far as geological models go, you know, we are looking at quite a varied number of models. A lot of them fairly large scale, but we'd just like to get the results back from the current on-site programs.
And you were saying that about 20 kilometres away, there is a gold copper mine already in production.
So about 20 kilometres to the north, Paulsens is an operating gold mine. 10 kilometres to the north, we've got another project, which is a copper gold project as well, which is called Mount Clement. There's also a part of Mount Clement which is currently being drilled for antimony. So there are a lot of commodities in this area, you know, that are extremely interesting, and you know, a lot of activity going on. So, you know, at the end of the day, what it means is with operating plants in the area, potentially there's somewhere, if you know, other places that you can process ore.
So obviously this area is geologically producing metals in general, so there must have been some thermodynamic situation under the ground for all of this to happen.
Look, there is, and there's some interconnecting structures. There's a major dike that comes down from the Paulsons operation, comes down through Mount Clement and comes down through Green Rocks, and then off this east-west off this main structure, we have a hold of the copper and gold mineralisation that's been sampled at surface. I believe, you know, that there is obviously some some connectivity between all these, and you know, it potentially does indicate some district scale mineralisation.
Very good. Okay, so let's move on to the one that the last raise was involved in, to pay for 51% of the option agreement then on Peak Hill. Tell us a little bit about that. For instance, where is it? Is it gold, copper, gold? Are there any other minerals in either of these as well, other than just copper and gold? Do we have any silver credits? Do we have anything else that is potentially in the ground?
Look, so the focus of the Peak Hill project is for copper and gold. The project is located about 70 kilometres north of Meekatharra. Meekatharra is the largest regional town in the area and has, you know, numerous operating and large gold processing plants. Meekatharra is about like probably a 9-hour drive northeast of Perth. You know, the area around Peak Hill over the last few years has been very, very focused on for copper. One of the large discoveries in the area was DeGrussa by Sandfire, a very, high grade and company changing discovery and subsequent mine. But, you know, there's a decent sized database that comes with this project. It's hasn't been looked at a lot for gold, but there's some seriously good results. Some historic drillings, like, you know, 2 meters at 21.9 grams from 24 meters, you know, 2 meters at 3.67 grams per ton from 16 meters, you know, 4 at 3.79 from surface. And these types of grades are, like, you know, more than economic in the current gold environment. They're very shallow. The advantage with shallow mineralisation is it's inherently cheap to drill. So, you know, you can get a lot of bang for your buck on exploration dollars. Being very, very close to Meekatharra means you've got all the services that you need to support drilling. And like I say, easy to get to. So, you know, again, a project that we think can move up the value chain quite quickly. You know, and provide decent news flow for Forgent.
And I think just to jump in there, this sort of bang for your exploration buck is really interesting. You know, the bang for your exploration buck is really interesting. It's about balancing capital up front with the upside potential. And we think these assets really provide that, you know, with a relatively small amount of capital, we can unlock a huge amount of value in a short time frame. That's the sweet spot of these assets, right?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, you only need to hit a few or drill a few holes, and in both Green Rock and Peak Hill, I presume the asset is not far from surface. You're not talking about drilling 500 meters to try and find gold.
Absolutely, because that's the biggest problem with drilling, right? Like, everything you really want to try and target in first round, you want to be, if you can get it for less than 100 meters below the surface, then you're talking about very cheap drilling. And in Western Australia, you'd probably be looking for if we budget on reverse circulation drilling, we're looking in Australian dollars about $140 a meter. But as you get deeper and deeper, you then need to switch over to diamond, and then you're looking at about $400 a metre. So your exploration costs go up extremely quickly. And also the deeper that you're drilling, it's a time thing. So you spend so much more time trying to drill deep holes when you could actually be just drilling lots of shallow holes.
Yeah. And obviously the issue for both is to drill plenty of shallow holes and get a good geological model of what is there and potentially a resource. Is that basically what you're hoping to do within 2026?
100%. Maybe not get to the point of a resource would be a bit further out, but I agree with the drilling lots of holes to then that provides news flow, gives us an idea of the direction forward, and you know, yeah, we'll give a lot of direction to the company.
So is the plan with Forgent, you get your, you know, hopefully you get these great results, you eventually come out of the maiden resource. One would assume there'll be, you know, quite a lot of interest in the company at that stage, you know, either from the market or from, you know, competitors. Would the plan be to drill this out through to production, or do you see yourselves flipping the projects and then funding the EQ Tech? what's the plan?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, I'm not sure we need to sort of nail just one plan at this point. There are just various ways it could go. Obviously, at our current scale, we're not going to be taking this thing through to production, right? I mean, that's clear. The capital needed is not realistic for us. That may change. That may change quickly. We hope it does. It's our job to make it change, right? So, you know, if you look at other analog stocks, there are some that have taken it all the way through, not many. And probably a more natural thing is that you have some success. You sort of, you know, wrap it up, put a bow on it, and then you hand it over to a bigger boy who's got more capital to take it forward. And you either go again in that early stage exploration phase on other assets or whatever you do. So look, these are all success scenarios and that's a luxury problem to have. But, you know, my guess is we're probably not taking these things through to production. We really want to ride this early stage, maximum value accretion, minimum capital. That's the phase we're in today. That doesn't preclude other phases later. And don't forget the gasification. I mean, you know, if that works, and we expect it to, and we expect it to this year, but it's not going to be in the next 3 months, in my view. Now, it may come in surprises. I hope it does. But, you know, the idea here was to give it a bit of breathing space, that gestation I sort of alluded to earlier. And then, you know, around the end of the year, hopefully we see some success there. And then these things sort of crescendo together. I mean, that's very much the design of the portfolio. We have got other assets we want to pull in here. But we start cautious. We're thinking dilution. We're thinking, you know, let's see how, you know, Green Rock gets on in the summer first. You know, there's no great desire to do it at pace. But, you know, we do want a broader portfolio. We do see opportunity in the world as it stands in this sort of mining space around critical metals and so on, you know.
Okay, so is Green Rock your first target for drilling, or do you go
big hills? Yeah. No, I think Green Rock, just a phasing of it. You know, we picked up 99% at the outset when we relaunched, and the intent there really was to have it, you know, lined up for summer drilling. And we're on track for that. As Ed said, we've got people on site at the moment, and that's sort of the plan. So there are five discrete prospects there. We want to see those drilled. I mean, that's when the rubber hits the road here. So, you know, on Peak Hills, 51% position, actually subject to the GM 14th of May, just to flag that full disclosure. But, you know, once we've secured that, that is a much bigger asset. It's a more mature asset. It's had drilling already. It's got more prospects. We do want to get drilling there, but it's going to be inevitably after the summer. It's more towards back end of the year, I think. So, and that's in a way the design is to have, you know, a constant news flow, a chain of activity that's sustaining the company. You know, we've all been doing AIM for quite a long time here. We know the recipe of what makes a successful company. That doesn't mean we always get it right, by the way, but at least we understand what that formula should be. And that's what we're working to create here. From quite a strong start, I mean, whilst, as Kevin, you said at the beginning, the EQ Tech history is patchy and complicated, actually therein lies the opportunity as well, right? Because none of that upside has gone away. That's still there. And now we're adding to it.
I was going to say the other additional point, probably slightly raised before, is about like what other commodities. Everything we always do multi-element assays on all work that's ever done. So it won't be the first time that somebody goes out to look for copper and finds a different deposit. So, you know, it's like our focus is clearly copper and gold, but we do multi-element for effectively a large chunk of the periodic table. And there are always other things that might be found that you just don't know about.
Indeed, in these areas.
About, hopefully.
Yeah. So what we're looking at here with Forgent, £3 million market capitalization. You basically have EcuTech as a free hit, really. If we have an upside on EcuTech, that's going to turbocharge this stock for sure, because there's no doubt that if it works and it's proven and it becomes economical, you're going to have some serious revenues coming in over the next period of time. And then you've got two assets, which I think it would be hard to say that they're not worth £3 million at this moment in time, even before you've drilled them, because you know, the options alone you've paid that sort of money for them. So, yeah, I mean, if you want something that's right at the beginning of the story, here we are. We've got EcuTech, which there are a lot of people hurting and a lot of people have lost a lot of money on it. But right now, you are entering it for free, and you've got copper gold. I mean, I'm a big copper bull and a big gold bull and also silver, because they're real assets. And I think when we're in this world where basically the world currencies are not collapsing yet, but they're not far away from it because of the amount of debt involved in the world, then I think a company that's invested in looking for copper and gold and other assets is going to be worth a significant amount. I can see copper $6, $7, $8 a pound, which is $14,000, $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 for sure. And I can see gold moving towards $10,000, not $5,000 an ounce in the future. If those things happen, then your market cap is going to be laughable.
Yeah. And let me add one more thing. You know, it's important to remember the basics here of cash flows and cost base. And one of the other strands of the relaunch is to take cost out. So, you know, we've taken out, since I've been here, 53, 54% of our cost of our G&A and O&M. So, you know, across the board, obviously that's always painful. They're hard miles, but it's necessary. And we're very focused on that. So, you know, we are not just looking at the upside, but we're also paying attention to the basics here. And you know, where possible, we're taking, you know, cost out, people out all the time. And that's an important, I think, philosophical sort of banner for an AIM company of this scale. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear as well. It's an important piece.
Yeah, well, we look forward to following your story over the next period of time.
Fantastic. And we hope to come back and, you know, specifically on the basis of what's going on over the summer and the countdown to that drilling, we'd love to come back and update you on the story. We should have some news soon when we have the team come back from site and, you know, with photos and videos and all those sort of things. So love to connect again around those.
Okay. Well, James Parsons and Ed Mead, thank you very much for being on Monday Upbeat Markets. We look forward to watching you progress.
Brilliant. Thanks for your time.
Yes, thanks.
So welcome our second guest, David. I'm not going to pronounce your second name as well because I'm rubbish at pronouncing names, so apologies, David. David from Acuity Risk Management. Charles, take it away.
Hi, David. How are you?
Hello, Charles. Yep. Good to see you again.
Enjoying the sunshine in the UK for once.
It's a beautiful weekend, and Monday's off to a great start as well, so absolutely.
Beautiful, beautiful. I've had a quick, you know, kind of look through Acuity. I think it's interesting because obviously the market cap is fairly low, but actually the underlying business proposition of what you have, the recurring revenue, the government contracts, the defense sector angle, and then the AI applications you're going after, it's all actually looking rather interesting. I think we probably want to start with this, which is that you've been profitable since October 2025. And the question is, you know, A, why has the market not recognized that? But also B, what's driven that move? Is it cost cutting? Is it revenue growth? And how confident are you that that holds true over the next 12 months?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, why are our stock is so undervalued? We've had a number of new shareholders come onto the register, and this is the first time they can divest their shares. So I think that is holding the share price back a bit. There's a bit too much supply out there. The in terms of where we've gotten to, yes, we've achieved profitability largely on cost cutting. We certainly do have a few interesting prospects in the pipeline, but the majority has been cost cutting. It certainly is sustainable. The pipeline's looking stronger. We've just released Stream Cloud, which opens up a whole new market segment. So I think the revenue outlook looks pretty solid in the quarters ahead as well. But yeah, I'm very confident in our ability to sustain profitability going forward.
Good. I mean, the defense pilot, I think, is probably one of the more interesting parts of the investment case, because that was announced back in October and is potentially transformative. Obviously, the actual contract value was, is pilot value phase. And multi-nation defense contracts are notoriously long and unpredictable to close. But, if that pilot does come back successfully, that could be a huge catalyst of a company, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of growth potential in there, because, as you mentioned, it is multi-nation. There's multiple defense contractors involved. So there is quite a bit of potential. The proof of concept is going well, and everything is on track. So we're probably looking at early quarter three for some of that to start coming in, I have a high degree of confidence that it will come in. Timing is always, as you mentioned, is a bit uncertain, but yeah, usually our defense and public sector contracts that are in the pipeline, they generally close. It's just really a matter of timing.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of which, Stop Prosteria, that relationship, you're under discussions. That's one of the largest IT suppliers to the UK government. So if you embedded Stream in their go-to market, that would be a genuine step change in distribution. How advanced are those discussions comparatively?
I can't say a whole lot about that particular one.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you can't. That's generally good news. It's when you can talk a lot is when it generally means nothing's going to happen.
I will say there are some very interesting channel partnerships in the works. They're not the only defense contractor out there. So there's some exciting stuff, but it's too early to comment on specifics, but there are some channel partnerships where it could significantly change the game.
Yeah, and I think it's the case with defense sector, but just government contracts in general. It's actually quite hard to get your foot in the door, whether you're privately listed or a public company. But once you have that foot in the door, the revenue tends to recur, so it's sticky. But also, if they like what you have, it snowballs quite quickly.
Yeah,
Would that apply to your business model?
Yes, absolutely. So that's how we've grown through the UK public sector. It's generally by word of mouth, and these people are very difficult to market to because they don't want to get inundated with requests and pitches, etc. But we are delivering well, and that's how we're spreading throughout the UK public sector, and that I expect that to continue. In fact, there are many discussions ongoing with many different parts of the public sector and their defense contractor ecosystem, and more we are the standard for cyber GRC within the UK public sector.
Yeah, which is a good place to be. But it's interesting you say you're the standard, because Stream Cloud's launch was initially delayed because its quality didn't meet your own internal standards, which was the right call, obviously. But I'd like to understand what happened. So what's you may not be able to say, but if you can, what specifically was it that fell short during the initial next gen Stream rollout that you wanted to fix before you sent it out into the wider world?
Yeah, there were a number of things. There was as you mentioned, quality issues. We ended up changing up our who was doing the development, and the silver lining of that was the fact that we found a very strong developer who's strong in terms of understanding how to build software products, as well as and what to build, and not only good at engineering or development. So that gives us capability to extend rapidly what Stream Cloud can do. And we do have some ambitious plans in terms of what Stream Cloud can become. And in addition to that, a more AI native product that we're now that we're calling Risk OS at the present time.
Yeah, and the AI native product is potentially the one that's going to be the step change for the company, right?
That is where, yes, that will be the step change. I think with Stream Cloud, the distribution channels that we're developing also can provide a step change even before we finally develop our new AI native product. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of potential game changing activities that are happening now.
Yeah, and then you listed VMH on AWS, Amazon Marketplace, mm-hmm. as well, which is a pretty clever distribution move in theory, because it removes that procurement friction for buyers already spending on the AWS platform. But obviously, being listed and being discovered are different things, mm-hmm. as any seller will tell you. So what? It's tricky, isn't it? Because you don't want to spend too much money on the marketing, because it can be expensive on there. So what's the balance?
Yeah, I think that was one of those plays to see if there was latent demand out there. I'm more excited about Stream Cloud and its future, and potentially even taking in some of that functionality that already exists in order to simplify our product portfolio. So I don't want to get too much into future strategy for competitive and commercial reasons. However, I think that the ability to develop product-led growth, that's one area very generally we're looking at, which in a very oversimplified way means clients can come in with their credit card, sign up, and get access and start getting value very quickly.
Yeah.
And that's something that will happen with Stream Cloud over time. And with Stream Cloud and these new channel partnerships that we're developing, if you combine those two, so for instance, if the supply base of a large defense contractor were able to come in, purchase Stream Cloud, remediate the issues that are identified with their cyber risk management, and sign up without any friction, that unlocks a potential large go-to-market opportunity.
It is interesting. We're kind of a bit forward-looking, but actually, forward contracted revenues, £2.1 million, 86% recurring subscription revenue, very healthy. I'd suggest that the only potential risk is concentration risks. You have 70 customers by last count. How many of those are, do you have 70 sort of customers where the revenue is split evenly? Or is it 70 customers where there's one or two customers with the lion's share of the revenue?
Yeah, I think the latest count is around 60 customers. But yes, we don't have a great deal of concentration risk. Because even though many of our clients are within the UK public sector, they're generally different budgets and different departments. So the concentration, any one contracting entity is quite small. We've got quite a varied client base in terms of using Stream Classic for one use case all the way to very complex risk modeling that where we're charging in the tens of thousands and even into the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Well, it's that mid-market approach, right, with Stream Cloud. organization is a bit too complex for spreadsheets, but too cost conscious for full enterprise implementation. So yeah, obviously it's a big addressable market, but I imagine quite competitive as well. So, you know, what's the go-to market strategy, I guess, as a former salesperson?
Yeah, so yeah, it is mid-market. So we're talking 1,000 to 5,000 employees. Those that are highly regulated organizations, there'll be organizations that are looking, that are currently using spreadsheets, or there are, or there is no formal cyber risk program. And surprisingly, even in today's world, many of those mid-market organizations don't have a very mature program, and even the ones that do have some sort of program are still using spreadsheets, which
David, I've worked with FTSE 100 companies where the entire business case rests on an Excel spreadsheet, right? That is unlocked and freely sent among personal emails. And you kind of have like a culture shock when you start. And then, you know, you email compliance and they go, yeah, that's just the way we've always done it. You go, right, one day this is going to come bite you.
Yes. But,
you know, they don't seem to listen.
Yeah. So I think so part of the strategy as well is through distribution. So we're in discussions with some channel partners that would allow us to get StreamCloud, that love StreamCloud initially, and would be able to get it in front of many thousands of potential buyers. So that's
fantastic.
That's the name of the game in software today is distribution, because costs for building software for those that can do it well, those are coming down. But it's understanding what to build and also then having those channel partnerships that will make the big difference.
Okay, the final couple of questions, because it is early on the Monday morning. We've got work to do. Every technology in the world is talking about artificial intelligence right now. Every company, and most of it is retrofitted onto existing products, which it, in many cases, from experience, just doesn't work. So you've described this AI native product in development, and a prototype has already been built. Without giving the game away too much, what is it that this product will be able to do that Stream Classic and Cloud don't? Who is it for? And when do you hope it could generate some revenue for the company?
Yeah, so this is another mid-market play, 1,000 to 5,000 employees. There are people in this space, but we're going to be coming at it from a different angle. What it will do is provide, so basically it's not another endpoint solution, because there are many endpoint solutions out there, and CISOs are drowning in data and alerts that are coming at them. And what the new AI native product will do is take in that data, make sense of it, and provide an operating cadence, so a weekly cadence for CISOs and their teams to follow to understand which actions will have the biggest impact for them. The other element of RiskOS that will be addressed is the fact that boards now are more and more personally responsible for the cyber risk posture of their organizations. And this will translate all these alerts and the technical details into a language and an understanding that will work for boards in business terms.
That was a very good political non-answer. Thank you. Final one from me, sir. So you became CEO in December last year, so very recently, but you were a non-exec previously, right?
Yes.
And you know, for people listening will know what a non-executive, but non-executive means you don't have any real control over the company. You're just monitoring it to make sure that everything is done to standard, right?
Yes.
So then, you know, you had a front row seat to the way things were done previously, and now to the way things are being done now. What's the most important thing that previous management weren't doing that you are doing, do you think? Without trying to, you know, because it's a tricky question to ask and to answer.
Yeah.
But I think it's about a strategic pivot, I guess. What's happening differently?
Yes. Yeah, so we are much more focused now. So we've instead of going for the larger GRC market, which opens up competition with a number of different players in the field. We've focused ourselves on cyber GRC and to make it even more digestible for the investors out there. So cyber risk management. So we've focused the company in terms of strategy, which allows us to move faster, make better decisions. The other element that we've done is streamlined the organization. So we've taken out unnecessary costs. The decision-making process is much more rapid. And in the software world, that is really important. You need to move quickly, build quickly. We're able to say no to things that are not within our focus, which will allow us to actually deliver products that the market wants, and also market and sell those products as well.
So David, I'm going to ask you a question. You might not be able to answer this question, but sure, they're the questions I like to ask. So you currently got a revenue of 2.1 million or somewhere in that region, and you are positive from a cash flow perspective. If I was to give you a wish, what is the company's goal 12 months from now in terms of revenue and in terms of the percentage return now? Because I presume as you add now, it almost becomes all profit every time you add.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are making our way toward becoming cash generative. We're not there yet. We are certainly making progress. There's some historical elements that I won't go into, but certainly making progress. In terms of the next 12 months, I don't want to put a figure on it. We're not releasing our expectations publicly at this time. I will say that in 12 months' time, I expect to be growing fairly rapidly. Stream Cloud just launched, some really strong potential channel partnerships, as well as the ability to develop fairly rapidly our new AI native product. And at that point, I feel like we will unlock significant and rapid growth, and we'll be in a completely different position than where we are today.
Okay, very politically well answered. And I knew you couldn't give me a number. But I think looking at the potential here, it isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that you can certainly increase your revenue by 50% to 100% in a year from the base that you're at. But that's me saying it, not you. So, listen, we look forward to seeing how things progress over the next few weeks and months ahead. And, Charles has written an article, just so everybody knows. That's going to be coming out in the next couple of days. And we'll see how things go in terms of the share price, because you seem realistically very undervalued at this moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the one other element that I didn't mention yet that we're going to be doing is transforming the business. Building this AI native product is one element, but also transforming the business in terms of efficiency with AI. So as we grow, we will continue to have even better operating leverage. So every new client that we encounter will be able to serve at a lower cost than we even currently do. And it just will allow us to extend the reach for all the great work that we're doing now. I appreciate the opportunity, Kevin and Charles.
Great. Look forward to speaking to you in the not too distant future. And thanks again, David.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Charles.
Right.
All right. Take care.
Okay, Charles. So here we are, Monday, 27th of April. What's been happening on the markets today? We've had a few RNSs. Anything that sticks out for you?
Nothing massively sticks out on this particular market. Monday is often the day where you get the most RNSs, don't you? But it doesn't seem to be that there's been that much coming through.
No, there was the Energy Pathways RNS, which wasn't the one we were all waiting for, that came today, to do with the Costin Group basically completing initial engineering studies, which is all well and good, but we need a bloody license from the UK government. What do you think?
Yeah, well, indeed. I think energy pathways is now, we're on that pathway, right, where it's gone up, it's gone down. It's like the grand old Duke of York with his 10,000 men. But until you get the big one, it's just not going to rocket, you know. It's a little bit binary. But at the same time, I think Ed Miliband, who was effectively the architect behind the Section 35 sign-off, not too long in the distant past, his star is ascending and Keir Starmer's is falling. Whether that's good for the country or not, I won't comment. But for energy pathways, I think could be very, very good.
Yeah, it should be, shouldn't it? I did actually speak to Ben Klube last week during the week. In fact, speak is the wrong word. We messaged each other. And I said to him, what's happening? He just said, lots. And I said, is it the right lots? And he just put the thumbs up. So here's hoping that we get some movement in that direction in the not too distant future. Yeah, I didn't see much more in terms of stuff that came out from the RNSs, to be honest with you. There really wasn't that great a deal. One of the things that did surprise me last week was when Active Energy had that news on Friday. We started to go great guns and up to 0.18, and then somebody basically smashed it and they sold the hell out of it. I don't know. I have my doubts. I think basically people who are holding the 0.1 warrants basically smashed it on the basis that they can't lose because they can replace the shorts by the 0.1 shares. But again, it's only an analysis.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's multiple possible things that can happen. I mean, share price shoots up, take profit. You know, some people are going to. But if it is the warrants, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, warrants get exercised, it's irritating, but money goes into the company. You know, so
yeah, that
does help. You know?
It's not the worst thing that could happen. But, I mean, there was a billion shares traded. This was like 25% of the company.
Yeah. Which is a hell of a lot. Think about it. Yeah, but it's also good news because it means that those shares are being moved from people who aren't going to hold it, presumably to people who might do. That does make a big difference when you're building a platform for the next move up. I think.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, more broadly, though, something I'm finding quite interesting. I mean, I predicted it at the start of the year. The IPO pipeline is really starting to gear up now. You know, I don't know about you, but the number of pre-IPO and IPO deals now being sort of sent through London is just way more than it was last year and way more than the year before. I mean, we've got another one come out this morning. Red Capital PLC is a proposed fundraise. Is going to rename itself. And they've got Scott Gilbert on as non-executive chairman of Corsell, and then Greg Gilbert as chief executive officer. And they're going after Venezuelan assets. That could do really, really well. Simply just because of the people involved. But more broadly, I mean, I don't know about you, but it just seems to be a lot of deals that have kind of been waiting for the right time to launch. They're launching now. And it could be quite an exciting time to be in the space.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there are going to be more and more IPOs and pre-IPOs, but all I would say to people is, not be cautious, but make sure you pick the right ones, which isn't always the easiest. They're not all going to be the right ones, that's for sure.
No.
You know, when I look back now in 2024, we didn't have any IPOs. It was almost dead. Last year, yeah, we had a few, and literally a few.
Flattering.
Yeah, I mean, and Delta Gold was one of the big successes of that. Listed or pre-IPO'd in the middle of last year. December, then IPO'd and has, you know, gone great guns since, and I think still going to go further. But you're right, since sort of late last year, January, February, March, April, we've had a few, haven't we? We had Halo, we've had Rift Helium. There was another one
today.
As well, Serval today. So, yeah, you know, there's three that you can just name straight off, and I'm sure there's more. It's going to be interesting times.
I guess we shall see. I mean, the one thing I would say is, you know, a lot of companies raising capital at the pre-IPO stage, and it feels like, you know, quote unquote free money. It's not. It tends to be the case that the company launches, you need to support it a little bit financially during the IPO stage as well, and then the trading as you go. And by the time you get to the point where your shares unlock, you own a material percentage of the company and can't sell them anyway. So you better have a good business case overall.
Yeah, you don't want to be doing it just because it's a pre-IPO, as we say, or even an IPO, because it needs to go. I mean, there was some pretty bad ones last year as well. What was that one that was in Australia that didn't hit? Do you remember what it was called? The one that came out of Power Metals?
First Development Resources. Yeah.
First Development Resources, which basically messed up that first drill. Not their fault necessarily, but that was a hit and miss situation, wasn't it? So, and it missed.
I think that one, it was, from memory, it was 1200 meters deep, you know. So I took a little bit, had a small position, but 1.2 kilometers under the earth, things go wrong, you know. Like and that's basically what happened with the drill. I don't think it was even that it went poorly. I think it didn't even hit the target. Interestingly, with that one, shares have sold off so massively. They're still cash in the company. They're going now after the rare earths project. It might be a turnaround play, but obviously the IPO itself, you know, what the primary reason for IPOing just hasn't worked out yet, which is a bit sad.
Just look at the ones that have done the best so far this year. You've got Kendrick Resources, which is rare earths. It's up over 1,000% since January. You said you had some, and obviously had written them off, and then all of a sudden, boom, which is a nice position to be in.
It's the same as Mtango, right? You know, I bought shares in that company in 2023. Not many, to be honest. I mean, it didn't affect me materially. And they were down massively at one point. And then obviously it became a star stock and shot right back up. So yeah, often it is the case, you know, particularly when you're buying shares and you think Kendrick was a little bit different because they acquired the rare earth project and then it re-rated off that. But yeah. Pango, they had those assets forever, and I was right. It just took a lot longer than I thought it would take. So there's a lesson there, potentially, about waiting.
Yeah, absolutely. Indeed. Well, listen, thanks for tuning in to Monday's Upbeat Market. We need Graham here now just to say, and remember,
mum's the word.
This podcast was brought to you by Monday Upbeat Markets. If you would like to appear on a future episode of the Mum's Podcast, please email mondayupbeatmarkets@gmail.com.